This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling.
This episode is brought to you by The Farmer's Dog, a service that delivers gently cooked, freshly made pet food straight to your door. Each balanced recipe is developed by board-certified nutritionists and clinically proven to support healthy aging. The Farmer's Dog, guided by science, driven by love. New customer? Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/Spotify. Plus, you get free shipping.
Tito's Handmade Vodka is America's favorite vodka for a reason. From the first legal distillery in Texas, Tito's is 6 times distilled till it's just right. And naturally gluten-free, making it a high-quality spirit that mixes with just about anything. From the smoothest martinis to the best Bloody Marys. Tito's is known for giving back, teaming up with nonprofits to serve its communities and do good for dogs. Make your next cocktail with Tito's. Distilled and bottled by 5th Generation Inc., Austin, Texas. 40% alcohol by volume. Savor responsibly.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. How are you? I'm Mary Walter, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. Coming up later this hour, we're going to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. He is always a great host. You can always join me during the show, obviously not when we have a guest on. 866-408-7669 is my number, 866-408-7669. And of course, just tag me in a post on X if you want to comment about whatever it is we're discussing, and we'll be happy to do that as well with you. Do we have our guest? We do. Oh, I didn't see him up on the thing. I didn't see him up on the screen. My bad. Joining us now, one of my favorite guests, Daniel Turner. He is the founder of the energy advocacy group Power the Future. You can follow him on X at Daniel Turner PTF for Power the Future. Daniel, happy new year. Welcome to the show.
Happy new year to you and one of my favorite hosts. It's great to be on with you.
Oh, you're so nice. Thank you. So we're talking about energy, and you know, President Trump really unleashed, first time he was in office and now the second time, his first goal has always been to unleash America's energy potential, right? And we have seen prices of gas come down, except in blue states where they tax the hell out of it, in which case it doesn't come down. And then people in blue states scream that Donald Trump's not doing enough. So he did that. And I want to ask you, how did he do that? How did he make it come down in less than a year, drive the price of gas down?
He did that through a virtue for which he gets very little credit, and it's called humility. And I mean that in all seriousness. I think Donald Trump, when it comes to oil and gas, is humble enough to say, hey, you guys know what you're doing. How about I just let you do it? Right? Donald Trump believes in free markets and free people. We didn't discover a new oil patch in 2017, his first term, 2025, his second term. We didn't discover a new oil patch. We didn't discover a new technology. What we had was a president who said, you all are oil and gas developers, producers. If I get the government off your back, what will happen? What will happen is you will produce more for a greater number of people at a lower price point. The opposite of that, that lack of humility, and maybe to call Joe Biden a statist, it's Christmas season, I'm trying to be good, right? So let's just call him a statist. But people who believe in government and government control, Joe Biden would think, I have an energy plan, I have an energy policy, and the big hand of government is going to dictate how it will work. And what was the result, right? The result was accusations of profiteering and price gouging and $140 a barrel oil. So the biggest difference between these two philosophies is, quite honestly, the humility to say, you know what you're doing in this space and government is an impediment. How about we get out of your way and you guys do what you do best? And if we had that sort of humility across all sectors of our economy, imagine how much more America would be thriving.
No, it would be incredible. I don't see the pushback this time around on President Trump increasing oil production here in America. We have enough of our own resources to be able to power America on our own and not be holding to anyone else and not be waiting for shipments of oil to come from, over the UAE and, sure. and Saudi Arabia, Middle East. That was the word I was looking for, Middle East. to get that oil here. Are there plans to drill, baby drill, and get more of our own oil from where, right here in the United States?
Yeah, and it would be remarkable to think if we didn't have that four-year hiatus of the Biden-Harris administration, where we would be. We had reached record oil production back in pre-COVID, right? 2019, we crossed that 13.3, 13.4 million barrels a day, and we were headed in a greater direction. Then obviously COVID happened, Biden happened. We're back to that level. We've slightly surpassed it, so we're back at record level. But it takes a while to bring oil to market, right? The oil that you're putting into the gas you're putting into your car was crude in the ground not very long ago, but that well was drilled 5-6 years ago, right? It is a very slow process to actually bring oil to market. And so when you have this hiatus of tinkering, and that's just, again, a nice thing we'll say about Biden-Harris, they tinkered. When you have that four-year hiatus, it creates a lot of havoc, and you can't restart that machine very quickly. So absolutely, drill, baby, drill is a great tagline, but it is also a belief that we have a lot of oil. We don't need to get it from Venezuela. Our allies should not be getting it from Russia or Iran. A lot of bad people produce oil and get rich and do evil things with it. So let's have America be the world's leading oil country. And that is just good for world peace, world stability as well.
Yeah, when I said I don't see pushback, on your page, powerthefuture.com, there's a piece there, and you talk about how the Washington Post in an editorial acknowledged that climate policies, ideology-driven climate policies, are unaffordable.
Yeah.
And they call it the green madness. And I've noticed that that's really, all of that has died down. The outrage from the left seems to be cyclical. Like right now, they're outraged that people are exposing Somali fraud. Like, so right now they're all for fraud. So, yeah. So they're outraged about that. It's cyclical what they're outraged about. Have we finally gotten over the green energy agenda? Is that dead nail in the coffin, or will it resurrect itself, you know, 4 years down the road?
No, it's never dead. And you're right. The cyclical is the outrage is cyclical. And I think they're always looking for the next thing, right? The left does very well when they can capitalize on a national rage. It propels their activists and their voters. It brings in money. So they're always looking for a George Floyd moment. They're always looking for an Occupy Wall Street moment in the height of the Romney election, right, in 2012. Occupy Wall Street. They're always looking for something to capitalize on. So they've tried the ballroom, right? They tried ICE raids. They're looking for the new thing. Right now it's the Somali daycare centers. But the climate movement, you know, there are thousands of people in this space with huge offices here in beautiful Manhattan, in Washington, D.C., in San Francisco. Their 401ks are tied up in organizations that have $300 and $400 million operating budgets. They're not going away. Maybe their heads are down, right? And they're just trying to bide their time. But if you are in this space, much like the Somali daycare centers, it is not about the climate. It is about power. It is about money. And it is about bilking the taxpayers for as much as possible. They're not going to go away anytime soon. So, even though their moment isn't here, I never count the climate movement gone and out. It's like they're like all communists, right? They don't ever disappear. They just morph into something else.
Yeah. I wanted, along those lines, one of the things that President Trump did is he killed a lot of the windmill projects off the east coast of the United States. Did he kill all of them or only some of them?
I think he has put a moratorium on building them, and he's used national security protocols because they interfere with radar signals. They interfere with naval operations, and our coasts are supposed to protect us from God knows what will come across the oceans. So he's used that as the reasoning for stopping these wind farms. The first people to celebrate should be the whales. Right? Remember, for 4 years under Biden, we talked about hundreds of whales regularly. Now, I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in New York. My family still has a house in Rockaway. So I grew up in the Atlantic Ocean, as did all my ancestors. We never saw whales wash up on the water. We never saw, that wasn't a regular thing. And for the 4 years of Biden-Harris, regularly dozens and dozens of whales, annually, hundreds over the course of their administration, washed up on shore because of these sonar explorations, because of the offshore wind farms. Well, the whale, where were all the Save the Whale people, right? Where were?
Well, exactly. You know, I live at the Jersey Shore. So, you know, we would see, we had one that washed up not far from us at all, this huge whale. And not only that, dolphins were washing up as well on the shore. And I'm always tagging PETA in all of these posts on X about, like, well, here's another one, PETA, where is it? And they're silent. They are silent because they are willing to sacrifice animals on the altar of green energy.
Yes.
And these windmills are not only a security risk because of the radar, they interfere with radar apparently or something, but they're polluting in and of themselves. You have to take a boat out to each one, burning fossil fuel, to grease it with fossil fuel derivative, right? And then when they get beaten to heck in a hurricane off the coast, these big we have no way to dispose of these huge wind turbines. Like, there's those big huge blades, there's no way to dispose of them,
and they don't work. And that's the biggest problem.
Well, there's that. Yeah,
you look at countries that have embraced it a lot harder and longer than America, like the European Union, the UK. You know, they're paying four times what we pay for electricity. And you see their climate activists. In the case of the UK, David Miliband is the equivalent of their John Kerry, right? Their climate change czar, still saying how this is the future. This is the future. Well, it may be the future, but the present is awful, right? The present is four times the price of electricity. And unreliable grid. Factories are closing. The German economy is in full declination. It's in full contraction because German manufacturing can't thrive with German electricity prices. So you scratch your head and say, when the hell does the good part kick in of going green, right? Like, how much more do we have to invest? How much more time? How much more money until we start to see these great returns that were promised? And they never seem to come. We're always told, oh, but it will. It will one day. One day it's going to be great. It just never arrives.
Well, the payoff is maybe that Greta Thunberg stays out of your country and just stops annoying people. So the last thing before we run out of time, let's talk about AI. There's a lot, you know, Bernie Sanders is apoplectic about AI and the cost of electricity and the amount of electricity that is needed to power AI. So Bernie Sanders would love to get rid of it altogether. I'm pretty much calculating, you know, the return on investment for me. Like, will I be dead by the time this all finally just, you know, blows up? That's pretty much the way I calculate all of this. And Bernie Sanders will be dead by the time all of this blows up. So I'm not quite sure what he's upset about. What is the drain? And we're seeing these huge, like, we're seeing farms go away and these huge data centers that are being built on them to power all of this. Is this sustainable? Like, it kind of doesn't seem sustainable to me.
It's not. I do want to win the AI war. I don't want to cede that technology to communist China, who's our number one competition. I think AI has a lot of potential and promise, and there's a lot exciting. There's a lot scary about it, but, you know, I was around when the internet first started, and there was a lot of fear about the internet as well. So I understand people's apprehension, and they're a little leery about it. The problem here is that the amount of electricity that it requires is not sustainable. And electricity is a fixed commodity. And like all fixed commodities, if the demand starts to go through the roof, but the supply does not increase, the only thing that happens is prices go up. And that's what we have been seeing. And that's where, you know, sadly, electricity rates are projected to go even higher next year, because it's very easy to cut the ribbon for a data center. Mm-hmm. You get Mark Zuckerberg, you get all the press, and you say, you know, Meta's making historic investment, blah, blah, blah. It's not very exciting to build a nuclear plant or a coal plant or a natural gas plant. And we are in desperate need for fossil fuel electricity production. So that's going to be the biggest problem. You got a lot of blue state governors that want the ribbon cutting of data centers because it shows jobs and growth, etc., but they're not increasing electricity production. And that delta is going to be pain on the ratepayers.
Yeah, it really is. And in states like the People's Socialist Republic of New Jersey, of which I am an inmate, you know, they closed six power generating plants, a combination of coal and nuclear. And not only did they close them, they disabled them to make sure that they could not be brought easily back online. And now they're blaming Trump for the increase in electricity. And listen, we're getting overrun by the people from New York who are fleeing what they voted for. So they come to New Jersey and they're like, wow, it's so much less expensive here. So they don't care.
Yeah.
So they're never going to hold these people accountable because to them, it's so much less expensive while all the native born New Jerseyans beat feet and go elsewhere.
Yeah.
Daniel Turner, thank you so much. Such an interesting conversation. And check out the webpage, powerthefuture.com. It is lots of great articles there, a lot of information there. It's a good read. And you can follow him on X at Daniel Turner, PTF. I wish you a wonderful new year and lots of blessings in 2026.
Thank you so much, Mary. Great to be with you.
Thank you for joining me. More coming up on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Real American Freestyle is the first ever unscripted pro wrestling league created by Hulk Hogan, Chad Bronstein, Israel Martinez, and Eric Bischoff to give elite wrestlers a real shot at professional career. Real American Freestyle is where Olympians, world champions, and NCAA legends come to compete, not in a cage, not in a script, but on the mat in front of fans around the world. This is real wrestling, reimagined for today. The first event kicks off August 30th in Cleveland, featuring matchups with some of the best wrestlers on the planet. You've never seen wrestling like this. Learn more at realamericanfreestyle.com.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
It was the Democrats who actually slowed us down with energy production. We would have all the energy we would need and more, but it was bad public policy federally and in the states where they cut back, they closed gas plants, closed energy plants, didn't replace them with anything, and stopped pipelines. Again, their problem. Energy is the driver. When you don't have energy that's plentiful, you're in trouble. And finally, when we look at the whole panorama, they are the ones that voted for the biggest tax increase ever in the history of the United States of America, didn't vote for any of the tax cuts that we wanted that is going to help the economy so much. So how can they talk about this?
And that there was Congressman Jeff Van Drew out of New Jersey. And he's right. And in New Jersey, and I think in some other Democrat-run states, energy is a big problem. Look at California. Look at how they just have rolling brownouts, and they just accept it as a part of life. They just accept it. Imagine that. Imagine like third world countries where they just have rolling brownouts because they don't have the energy available to meet the needs. And in this country, we use a lot of energy because we're used to our air conditioning. You go to other countries, they live without air conditioning and they somehow survive. I know Americans could never do that, but they survive without air conditioning. How many of these greenies are willing to give up their AC in order to save the planet, if that's what they think it is? You ask them, they don't want to do it. No, but we'll have windmills, and that'll make enough energy for me to have my air conditioning. And we're going to have solar farms. And then you see the dead birds all around the solar farms because these things are huge, and they fly across them, which is the way they've always flown. But in the meantime, man built this huge solar farm, and all of that heat reflecting back up, and they fry. They fall out of the air, or the wind turbines, killing them as they fly through, and they get chopped up by the wind turbines. And what happens to these wind turbines in the ocean? And they're in an area where they maybe get hurricanes. You know, you don't have that problem in Europe. They don't get hurricanes. We do. They don't. Every now and then, one wanders across the ocean and makes it far enough to make an impact in England or Denmark or something like that. But it's very, very rare. So they're fighting for these things that worked elsewhere. But just because they worked in Denmark or Sweden or what, doesn't mean that they're going to work here. And the fact that we think that we can power everything with this is naive and ridiculous. And what they did in New Jersey, we just heard Jeff Van Drew from New Jersey. What the Democrats did in New Jersey is they destroyed, as I said to our guest, 6 coal and nuclear power plants. And they didn't just take them offline. They destroyed them so that they cannot be brought back online. It would take a huge investment to bring them back. And they didn't have anything to replace it. They had nothing to replace it. So now the cost of energy is skyrocketing. Coming up, Lieutenant Colonel Alan West will be joining us. He's always a great guest. That's next on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We talked about Hamas and we talked about disarmament. And they're going to be given a very short period of time to disarm. And we'll see how that works out. Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner will be in charge of that from our side. But if they don't disarm, as they agreed to do, they agreed to it, and then they'll be held to pay for them. And we don't want that.
Yes, the president at the White House meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, president of Israel. Excuse me. Oh, he's the, the president is Herzog. Sorry about that. But the two of them meeting at the White House, and there's so much happened in that meeting. There was so much that we have to cover with that. So let's do it with Lieutenant Colonel Alan West. He's a Dallas County Republican Party chair, American Constitutional Rights Union executive director, former Florida congressman. You can find him on West at on X at Alan West. Super easy. Welcome, my friend. How are you?
It's good to be with you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. So, you know, hearing the president say there that there will be hell to pay if Hamas doesn't disarm, what are the options open to the United States if Hamas chooses not to disarm? They say they're going to, but we all know they're not going to. Mm-hmm.
Well, of course they're not going to, and if you've been reading the recent reports, what they have done is they're reconstituting, they're reorganizing, they're trying to consolidate their power, they're eliminating any of those that they have deemed their opposition, aiding and working with Israel. So I think without a doubt, you have to turn to Israel and say, go in and finish the job, you know, because Hamas is a terrorist organization. Their charter calls for the eradication, elimination of the state of Israel and to kill Jews worldwide. And just recently, we saw a report coming out of Italy where there was a Somali-type scam where they were actually some gentleman was sending money to Hamas from Italy based upon, you know, some nonprofit organization. So they're still getting funding, and we should not be any way deceived about that. So I think that, yes, you're going to have to eliminate Hamas, and you have to eliminate Hezbollah, and especially now when Iran is in such a pitch that they can be financially cut off from these organizations.
So where does this go? Where do you see this going? Is this a slow slog? I thought we were supposed to be much farther down the road in the peace process between Hamas and Israel, and it seems to be bogged down. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. What's happening?
Well, first of all, I don't think you should legitimize and sit down at a table and talk about peace with a terrorist organization. They're not about having peace. They will try to stonewall and delay you. And again, use this as an opportunity. If you go back and you study Islamic history, the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, which is something that Muhammad did, where he entered into an agreement with his enemies, he had no desire to honor the treaty, but it was just an opportunity for him to rebuild his strength. And I think it was because 4 or 5 years later, he violated the treaty and attacked his enemies and destroyed them. So that's what Hamas, you know, sees as a model. And that's what they are using here as a delaying tactic. So I think you got to put the pressure back on them and understand that they're not about peace. They exist for one reason, and they cannot be the governing authority in Gaza.
You know, it seemed as if when they were speaking that Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump truly like each other on a personal level. We don't have time to play the audio, but Netanyahu announced that they're going to break with decades of tradition and they are going to award President Trump the Israel Prize, which normally is only given to Israeli citizens, but they're going to award it to Donald Trump. He said they decided to break convention to award him this prize. In almost 80 years, it's never been awarded to a non-Israeli. And I will say, when I was in Israel in August, when they saw Americans, I guess we stick out like sore thumbs, like they know we're Americans. they kept coming up to us, Trump, yeah, Trump, with thumbs up. And they love him in Israel. They love Donald Trump in Israel. And I see the connection between the two of them as akin to the connection between like Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and John Paul II. Mm-hmm. Right? Is this the one chance we have in time to finally get peace in the Middle East because of the connection between Netanyahu and Trump?
Yeah, I think that this is without a doubt a great first step. I mean, you had the Abraham Accords in Trump's first term, and we continue to build upon that. But also, you have to understand that part of peace is deterring your enemies and showing them your resolve and showing them your commitment. And I think that's what Donald Trump has done with his going after those nuclear facilities in Iran. And again, you see where they are supporting Israel so that they could do what is necessary, going after Hezbollah and Hamas. You know, the Israelis know what happened in the 8 years of Barack Obama. They know what happened in the 4 years of Joe Biden and the threats that fell upon them. But they do see a good working relationship for their safety and security with Donald Trump. And I know there's a lot of anti-Semitism going around the country right now, but it's very simple in that there is one true light in the Middle East, and that is Israel. And I think that also those other, you know, Arab nations, they want to see peace as well.
No, absolutely. I think that they've realized that Hamas is just insane, like they're crazy, and they won't even let them into their country, right? They don't have a place to live. We have all these people who are starving, and the most secure border in the world is the one between Egypt and Gaza because they don't want them. Mm-hmm. None of these Muslim countries want any of the Palestinians in their country, and that says a lot. I quickly want to go over to Ukraine and Russia and what's happening mm-hmm. there. President Trump meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky as well. And he was on with Brett Baer on Special Report. And this is Cut 13, Eric. I just want you to hear the exchange between the president and Brett Baer talking about territory. This is a big sticking point in the negotiations.
But that's the hard part.
Yeah.
Is the territory.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Yeah.
So how do you get to yes?
All the parties have to understand that the worst way is to go out from the Donbass. It will be big risks for Ukraine, not acceptable by Ukrainians, but they will, just personally. And referendum will not be positive.
So they don't want to give up the Donbass, but they do seem to be willing to give up some other areas that are contested right now. But he said he wants to put it up to a vote to the Ukrainian people to see if they want to, if they're willing with ceding certain parts, certain territories. It seems as if they're willing to do that. Is this a no-go for Russia, though? Do you think Russia says, no, Donbass is right up against us. We want it.
Well, I think that we have to come to a realization that Russia invaded a sovereign nation, and we cannot reward that type of bad behavior. You know, if you go back to the 1930s, we saw the exact same type of bad behavior. We saw a guy by the name of Adolf Hitler saying that he wanted an area called Sudetenland to protect ethnic Germans, and the world appeased him, and they continued to appease him, and they went into an agreement called the Munich Accords. And later on, Hitler, you know, said it was just a piece of paper, even though never changed. Chamberlain said that he had a signed document, you know, guaranteeing peace in our time. So I think the most important thing is we have to operate from a moral high ground to tell Russia, you're not going to be rewarded for your belligerent actions. You know, Vladimir Putin is a evil dictator, and he doesn't even care about his own people. He will continue to throw those young Russian men into the cauldron of death just so he can reestablish, I think, the Soviet Union in his mindset. So, yes, I believe that the Ukrainian people need to have a voice, because think about it. If someone came in and told us here in Texas we need to, you know, give back land to Mexico, do you think the Texans would be very happy about that? I don't think so.
No, obviously not. And I think that's the sticking point. And I don't know if President Trump can pull this one off if you have one side that just doesn't want peace. You know, they just don't seem to want peace. Like you said, Russians will just keep throwing their people into this. And I think maybe it would take coming from inside Russia in order to for them to demand to get this to stop. Coming up, I want to get a little bit closer to home. All right, so we're going to turn a little bit closer to home. I have some questions for you about some things happening here in this country. So we've got more coming up with Lieutenant Colonel Alan West on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
With the holidays coming, that means more gift buying and more deliveries to the front door. It made me think about how I should upgrade my security to keep away the porch pirates and keep my delivery safe. I went with SimpliSafe because it's proactive. Traditional systems react after a break-in. SimpliSafe can help stop a crime before it starts. That's because SimpliSafe keeps your home safe with a double layer of defense. First, you got cameras detecting potential threats, and then live agents confront them while they're still on the outside of your home before they have a chance to do any damage, telling them they're on camera and telling them the police will be dispatched if they do not leave. That's right, if they don't leave. That's why I trust SimpliSafe at my place to help protect my family, keep an eye on the dogs, and watch those deliveries, because real security stops crime before it starts. Right now is such a good time to get SimpliSafe. This month only, get 50% off any new system. Go to simplisafe.com/Brian. Again, that's simplisafe.com/Brian. There's no safe like SimpliSafe.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Mary Walter in for Brian Kilmeade with the one and only Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joining us here. Follow him on X at Alan West. That's super easy. So a little closer to home, sir. The statute of limitations for federal crimes related to the January 6th Capitol attack can extend up to 5 years, depending on the charges. And everyone is screaming and yelling. I see it all over social media. Where is our Attorney General Pam Bondi? Why is there no investigation? Is there an investigation into what happened? Like, who really had a hand in all of this? What was Nancy Pelosi's role in all of this? Why were some people let in through the open doors and escorted around and then later charged? There are a lot of questions regarding what really happened on January 6th, and it looks like our Attorney General is just going to let the statute of limitations run out. And there's a lot of frustration. Where is she?
Well, I can understand the frustration. It's not just that with January 6th. It's all of the corruption, everything that we see that emanates from the Marxist, socialist, leftist. I mean, we can just scratch the tip of the iceberg with the Somali issue. But the thing is, if we don't start to hold the left accountable, if we're always concerned about what the Washington Post and the New York Times or Vanity Fair is going to say, people are going to lose faith because you are elected to make sure that you reestablish the rule of law and not just the rule. If the left ever gets back in power in the United States of America, you know exactly what they're going to do. They're going to crush any opposition. We saw that happen. But we continue to see them, you know, violate the rule of law. And I'll be very honest. You know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris should have been impeached for violating the Constitution with the open borders policy. Alejandro Mayorkas should have been impeached, and he should have been put in jail for lying to Congress about saying the border is secure. All of these things need to be brought up, and these people need to be held accountable, not running off like Lois Lerner did with a six-figure taxpayer-funded retirement. So, yes, Pam Bondi and our system of justice in the Trump administration needs to step up and reestablish justice.
But they're not, and I think the frustration is that they're not. We see, you know, James Comey. Look at James Comey. James Comey and Letitia James, yeah. They somehow managed to blow that. They got indictments from grand juries for both of them, and then blew the case by putting up a lawyer who wasn't qualified, shouldn't have been in the courtroom under the law, which shouldn't have been there, and now the whole thing's blown up. Like, it just seems to be dumb mistakes. It seems to be incompetent. And you're right, the frustration is just boiling over on the right, because the DOJ kind of is appearing like the Keystone Cops.
Yeah, that's what they call, I think it's an unforced error in sports, and that should not happen. You should be very meticulous in these things and crossing your T's and dotting your I's. And, you know, again, when you hear the left always saying, oh, well, you're going to try to weaponize. Well, this is what they did for 4 years in the Biden administration. This is not about weaponizing. This is about holding people accountable. And as they say, the left says, let's make them eat those words. No one is above the law. So we supposed to believe that, you know, yeah, a mistake was made, but that doesn't excuse the people for the wrongs that they did. And those cases should be tried regardless. And someone else should be put in charge as the lawyer in charge of that, not just have anything, you know, the case or charges dismissed. There's still wrong that is there. But there's a whole litany of things, Mary, that you're absolutely right, that people are expecting. It's just year one, so maybe, you know, you can play the catch up, but it's got to happen. It's got to start to happen very quickly.
We can play the catch-up, but the statute of limitations runs out. So we could say, oh, look, this one did this, this one did that. And they're going to like be like, ha-ha, walking away with my pension. See ya. Because they're acting, and I understand Trump can't do everything, but you know what? Pam Bondi should have been prepared. Just like Donald Trump was so prepared when he came into office. He knew exactly what he was going to do. They flooded the field when they first came in, and they did boom, 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 boom. It was great. But it seems to have come to a screeching halt with the DOJ. And I don't know if it's Pam Bondi. I don't know what's going on over there. But that seems to me to be the biggest failing in the Trump administration, is the lack of accountability with these people when they have the chance to do so. They just don't seem to do it. Before we run out of time, I want to talk about Minnesota just a bit. We know that the fraud that is just emanating from Minnesota. And it's not just them. You're seeing fraud come out of California. The state audit estimates there's up to a $70 billion in fraud in California. Waste, fraud, and abuse. Not just fraud, but waste. And, you know, money that they just don't know what happened to it. Same thing coming out of Boston. We have it coming out of Maine. So it's all over the country, that the American taxpayers, we could probably never have to pay property taxes or income taxes ever again with the money that is being stolen from us. But listen to this in Minnesota. Minnesota, they have driver's licenses for all, and it does not, they have no marking on it, you know, indicating citizenship. So it looks just like a citizen's ID, which, of course, you need ID to vote, well, to register to vote. So, oh, look, I have this. But they allow a registered voter who is a citizen, who has, can present the ID, on the day of the election, vouch for up to eight other voters who swear that they're residents, they're my neighbors, and then they get to vote. And of course, it's verified, but after these people voted, vote doesn't count. This is insane.
Problem. Yeah. And when you think about it, you go back to last year's 2024 election, Kamala Harris, 12 of the states that she did win, they had no voter ID laws whatsoever. And so this is a huge issue. Even here in Texas, we have something called a reasonable impairment declaration, which enables people that, quote unquote, I don't have an opportunity to have an ID to be able to come in and vote. You can't even challenge that. This is how the left operates. And when you talk about the Somali community up there in Minnesota, that's a clannish criminal organization. And let's never forget that the community that supplied some of the most ISIS fighters during that crisis period during the Obama administration came out of Minnesota, came out of the Somali community. So we've got some things to clean up, but this is the result of the open borders policies of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. This is what they want. They want to flood the voting zone, and they want to be able to have people go out and vote. And they will use these nondescript means of identification as a, you know, the workaround to be able to do such. So it should be one person, one vote, and it should be only Americans. And I got to tell you another stickling point. I think that all of our ballots in the United States of America should be in English. God bless you, you know, coming from another country. But if you're going to vote in our elections, if you're an American citizen, you should know English.
Agree. And very quickly, I had an Uber ride yesterday. Super guy, super nice guy. It wasn't far. It was a very short little ride. But I said to him, I asked him a question, and he just looked at me and said, yes. He couldn't speak a lick of English whatsoever. And I thought, God forbid something happened. Like, I'm screwed. This dude doesn't speak English at all.
Look at those 18-wheel truck drivers who got all over the place. Yep. Can't speak English, can't read our road signs.
It's really, really bad. And I know they give the driver's license test in 14,000 different languages, but like to your point, they can't read the road signs. We got to run. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West, have a wonderful, wonderful 2026. I wish you all the best and many blessings.
God bless.
And thank you for joining me.
Thanks so much, Mary.
I'm Mary Walter. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Mary Walter, sitting in the seat for Brian. You know, I love when you join me. Feel free, 866-408-7669, 866-408-7669. You can always, as well, tag me in a post on X. It's Mary Walter Radio. There's no S. Tag me in a post on X, and I will try to read your comments. You know, try to get to them in a timely manner while I'm multitasking and doing the rest of the things in the show. Because I'm that good. Tonight, my live cast is tonight, 7:15 p.m. Eastern Time. It is live on Rumble, YouTube, and Getter, and you are invited to join in. And I don't have any special guests tonight since it's the last podcast before the new year. So it's the IT department, where if you are a regular on the live cast, you know who the IT department is. The IT department will be joining me. And you. So your comments, your questions, you will steer the show. And when that happens, it's usually all over the place, which makes me laugh, and it's kind of fun. So we'll be doing that. You can get the audio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Spreaker, and you can catch up. We have guests that are political. Lieutenant Colonel Alan West joins me a lot. We also have quite a few regulars that join in, and names that you will know, Hans von Spakovsky, Kelly Stimson, there's others. But then there's a lot of non-political guests as well. I've had directors on. I've had reporters who won't talk about politics because they're reporters, and so they talk about other things and writing a book. And we've had true crime people on, so it's a lot of different things. So I try to not make it just politics. So please join me. So yesterday, Benjamin Netanyahu joined President Trump, and I was really struck by a presser that they had. They got out, the two of them together, and they were speaking to the American people, and I was really struck by the whole thing. And now again, I went to Israel as a guest of the Israeli government on a diplomatic mission in August. And so I've really become interested in Israel and the people, and they were so welcoming and so nice. And you realize what they live under. There were pictures of the hostages everywhere. And you realize the threats that they live under. And we learned a lot about October 7th. We were at the Gaza border. We did get to speak to a woman at the site of the Nova Music Festival who they tried to kill at the Nova Music Festival, and she miraculously survived. And we went to one of the kibbutzes that were a stone's throw from this tiny little wire fence that separated the kibbutz from Gaza. And it was amazing that, it was just that close, and how they were just slaughtered. And so I learned a lot. So I'm very interested, and we did get to meet Prime Minister Netanyahu. We did get to meet President Herzog. We got to see Ambassador Mike Huckabee. So it was so educational, but you really got to get a feel for the Israeli people. So yesterday, Benjamin Netanyahu was at the White House, and he announced something very special. There is something called the Israel Prize, and it has been given out for almost 80 years now, and it has never been given to a non-Israeli until Benjamin Netanyahu decided to change those rules. Listen to this.
Well, President Trump has broken so many conventions to the surprise of people, and then they figure out, oh, well, maybe, you know, he was right after all. So we decided to break a convention, too, or create a new one, and that is to award the Israel Prize, which in almost our 80 years, we've never awarded it to a non-Israeli, and we're going to award it this year to President Trump. This was announced formally over lunch by our Minister of Education, who's responsible for the Israel Prize. It's going to be awarded to President Donald J. Trump for his tremendous contributions to Israel and the Jewish people. I think it's such a fitting thing, and it would honor us, obviously, Mr. President, if you could visit Israel in that occasion on our Independence Day. But I have to say that this reflects the overwhelming sentiment of Israelis across the spectrum. They appreciate what you've done to help Israel and to help our common battle against the terrorists and those who would destroy our civilization. So, again, that's an expression of thanks and appreciation.
And he's right. I was so surprised. Huge banners, you know, thank you, President Trump. They're all over Israel. There were not a lot of tourists when we were there. People are afraid to go, which I'll tell you, you don't have to be afraid to go. We spent most of our time in Jerusalem. We were in that part of the country. We went up to the West Bank. We were in the West Bank. We were in Capernaum and Galilee and traveled all over, but mostly we were stationed in Jerusalem. And I wound up spending 2 weeks there. And the people are wonderful and lovely, but as soon as they find out you're an American, they're like, oh, we love your president. We love Donald Trump. He's the best friend Israel ever had. They're really, really, and you will see signs everywhere. I saw a sign that said, make Gaza Israel again. So the takeoff on Make America Great Again. But they are huge fans of Donald Trump. And what I thought was interesting is there seems to be a genuine friendship. The two men seem to genuinely like each other. And I just wanted to play just a little bit here of what Benjamin Netanyahu had to say regarding the relationship with President Trump.
I have to say that in addition to what I said, that we've never had a friend, even close a friend, as President Trump in the White House, I think he's been extraordinary in his friendship and his support for Israel, his principled positions, his willingness to just cut through and get to the essence of things. And I don't say that as a compliment. I just mean it. People have heard me say that behind your back, Mr. President, many times. But I want to say something else. I think we have a partnership, if I can quote you, second to none. I think it's allowed us to do enormous things. You know, people said there was a different conception at one time, which means that America can advance its interests in the Middle East if it opens a lot of daylight between it and Israel. And President Trump has done the exact opposite. He's achieved remarkable things in the Middle East because we work together. We talk about our ideas. Sometimes we have different ideas, but we work it out. And most of the time we see eye to eye. But it's been a remarkable experience, and this was a very, very productive meeting. And may I say, a very good lunch. Thank you. Thank you for your friendship.
Thank you very much, Bailey.
And thank you for your support. It's meant from the heart.
And I really think it was. It was a very, very touching exchange that I watched yesterday. I think I'm sure a lot of you watched or saw it. And it was, as I said, like a very touching exchange between the two men. And I just wanted to share that with you. Also, the Southern Command announcing with the Joint Task Force Southern Spear that they carried out their first lethal strike since December 22nd, killing two alleged narco-terrorists aboard a vessel operated by a designated terrorist organization in international waters. Yeah, got another one. two male narco terrorists were killed. No U.S. military forces were harmed. It was the 30th. The strike was the 30th since September 2nd. Total number of people killed in such operations is at least 106. The campaign began September 2nd with a strike that killed 11 alleged members of Tren de Aragua, followed by additional operations that reportedly eliminated dozens more across known trafficking routes. The U.S. forces have reportedly hit bunch of different types of vessels, including submersibles, which I guess are submarines, fishing boats, and high-speed vessels. Oh, don't let the left hear you hit fishing boats. Uh-oh. But they were carrying drugs on them. Earlier this month, the administration launched its Fentanyl-Free America plan, with the DEA reporting that strikes on suspected Caribbean drug vessels are helping curb the flow of illegal drugs into the U.S. And Trump has indicated that they're going to start conducting strikes on land. Now, left can't get upset about that, because Barack Obama conducted a lot of strikes on land. A lot of them. Over 500. And he killed innocent civilians, and he also took out, purposely, an American citizen who had no charges or any crimes, wasn't charged with any kind of crime. He was the son of Anwar al-Awlaki, and so, boom, he went. So they really can't complain all that much. All right, coming up, a little bit more news, and then I want to get into something that was posted on X by a basketball player. And it's a very, very interesting thought, and I think we're going to have a lot of differing opinions on this. It's all coming up on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. You know, one of the perks about having four kids that you know about is actually getting a direct line to the big man up north. Mm-hmm. And this year, he wants you to know the best gift that you can give someone is the gift of Mint Mobile's unlimited wireless for $15 a month. Now, you don't even need to wrap it. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hope everyone's having a great day. I'm Mary Walter, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. All right, now's the time to get to join me. 866-408-7669, 866-408-7669, or tag me in a post on X at Mary Walter Radio, no S, Mary Walter Radio, and I'll try to get to that while I'm talking to other callers. So, here's the thing. Dwight Howard, basketball player, said, I honestly feel like the president should make 1 year of service mandatory for everyone born in America. A lot of other countries do it, and I think it would help with discipline and structure. I'm curious what y'all think. Would this help America or nah? So, and I'd love to get your thoughts on that. 866-408-7669. Now, he clearly has been listening to me, because I've been saying this for a long time. I firmly believe, because everybody's got a disability now. Everybody's got ADD, ADHD, OCD, anxiety, this, blah, 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 blah. Life's hard. Put on a helmet. I truly believe that everyone can contribute in some way. Whether you got ADD, ADHD, time blindness is another one I love. I just can't get up in time. Yeah, because you didn't have a mother who ripped you out of bed. My mother would come into my bedroom in the morning for school and open the curtains and be like, good morning, and you had to get out of bed, and she was not having any of it. And if you missed the bus, she was not driving you to school. You had to hoof it. If you missed the bus, she made us walk to school. She was having none of it. So anyway, everybody would complain, yes, but I'm disabled. Yes, but I have this, but I have that. I truly believe that everyone can contribute. Everyone can contribute. And I think contributing makes you feel good. I really do. You know, you may have, I don't know, whatever your disability is, but you can still be, answer phones at a desk for the military, for whatever, for a year. I'm a big fan of some kind of service. This country gives you so much that giving back 1 year is no big deal. A lot of kids take a gap year between high school and college, and I actually think that that's good, because when you go into college, a lot of kids have no clue what they want to study, or trade school or whatever it happens to be. And he's right. It would help with discipline and structure. Yes, it would. Honestly, I've always said they should bring back the draft, even if they just draft you into answering phones, right? Or they just draft you into food service or something like that. A lot of kids grow up without fathers, and some grow up with parents who just don't kick their butts and don't teach them, you know, responsibility and consequences and those things that parents used to be responsible for teaching. And, you know, one person posted here, Riley says, I think 1 year of customer service of any type, retail, serving, bartending, answering phones, etc., would help this country all understand each other and maybe even get along a little better. And I agree with that. I do think that, you know, listen, people are so rude now, so rude. I think COVID had a lot to do with it. A lot of you went into lockdown and sat around with your box of wine and watching whatever it was you were binge watching on TV. What was it? What was the thing about the tiger? Remember that thing, that show? I never had time to watch because I'm essential personnel, so I didn't get to just sit around and watch the shows that were popular at the time. Didn't get to do that. But a lot of you did. And you came out of COVID, and you did not learn how to deal with society. Nobody's polite anymore. Nobody's nice. People are rude. They just start screaming and yelling and having temper tantrums in the middle of the aisle. It's like you're all letting your freak flag fly, and you should just keep it home sometimes. Now, he responded to that and said, I think military service would be better. Learn how to defend yourself. Shoot and handle guns properly. The bond and respect for each other would go up. And someone said, America's a free nation for a reason. No. I don't know. I just think everybody would be... I just think we'd be better off as a country if everybody had to give 1 year back. That's it. 1 year. Addressing envelopes, I don't care. And I do believe, as I said, every human being has worth, every human being has value. And instead of, I guess, give them responsibilities. In the end, yeah, you're going to gripe and moan that you have to work or you have to do this or you have to do that. But in the end, there's a lot of dignity that is gained in contributing. Instead of just sitting back and having people wait on you or take care of you or whatever. But there's a lot of dignity in work, and you see it with these businesses that employ kids who are and adults who are mentally handicapped. Right, they're different, and I forget what the new politically correct term is, but you know what I'm talking about. And they love it. They go to work and they think it's fantastic. I love this. 866-408-7669. Tony in Florida, you're kicking it off. I got a minute and a half for you, Tony. Well, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you, and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
My take on your subject is I'm from a Navy family. I was in the Navy, and all my brothers and sisters were in the Navy. Six of us went in. And what I like to point out is that it teaches reliance, self-reliance, and discipline. Even if it's just 1 year, you learn how to work on a team, it's pretty much forced on you. And as you get better at it, you actually like it. Now, there'll be those kids that don't want to stick around and want to get out after the first year, but there may be 20% that will decide, hey, I like this. And they'll stick around and they'll get better at it and they'll be able to teach others.
So do you think it should be military service, as Dwight Howard says? He says, I prefer that it would be military service would be better. Or do you think it should be anything like working retail for a year? That in itself is one of Dante's circles of hell, having to work retail, if you've ever worked retail, right? Having to deal with people. It would give people a better appreciation of how to interact with people, because we lost common courtesy somewhere along the line.
Well, I think you're looking at two sides of the same coin. If you see it on the military side, it teaches you, your earlier caller said, as far as learning how to fire a weapon, respect for weaponry, and learning how to do all that stuff. Also, the camaraderie. Now, if you get into the service side of it, there are some who don't feel like they have to do it because they're the military, you have to do it. You're subject to the UCMJ, where if you're in the civilian side, you're just subject to common law. That changes as you get better and better at what you do in the military. So right. You're looking at two sides of the same coin. Either one would work. It just would depend on how you're screened. As far as recruiters go, they'll screen everybody and see whether you're actually suitable for military service or not.
Right. Tony, thank you so much for your service and your family's service, and I wish you a very blessed 2026. More of your calls coming up on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I'm Mary Walter in for Brian, taking your calls 866-408-7669 or tag me on a post on X at Mary Walter Radio. There's no S in that. So if you're just joining me, Dwight Howard, a basketball player, he tweeted this out. He said, I honestly feel like the president should make 1 year of service mandatory for everyone born in America. A lot of other countries do it, and I think it would help with discipline and structure. I'm curious what y'all think. Would this help America or not? And one person said, how about this? How about 1 year of customer service of any type, retail, serving, bartending, phones, etc.? It would help this country all understand each other and maybe even get along a little bit better. Very true. When someone's pitching a fit in Walmart for whatever reason, because they always, I don't understand it. I don't get, you know, pitching a fit like that and beating people up and stuff in the middle of Walmart, but they do. Maybe if you had worked in Walmart for a year in customer service, you know, having to deal with people, you might be a little more understanding and not let your freak flag fly right there in the middle of, you know, the grocery aisle of Walmart. So maybe that's good too. Now, of course, it's never going to happen in this country because too many people will scream because they don't want to get off their butts and have to do something. So it'll never happen. You can't make me do that. And I get it, but I like the idea behind it. I really do. When we got rid of the draft, I just think people's behavior and lack of courtesy, a lack of any kind of rules, of any kind of niceness has just grown, and it's exponential since COVID. You all forgot how to behave. You also forgot how to drive. None of you can drive either. That too. So what do you think? 866-408-7669, or again, reach out to me on X at Mary Walter Radio. Tag me in a post. Let's go to Brooklyn. Andrea listening on WABC. Andrea, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you also. Please, God, we need a good New Year. Yes, I wanted to just share my experience that I was a member of the VISTA program, Volunteers in Service to America, from late 1979 to early 1981. I did 2 years, even though I originally signed up. It was just a one-year program. It was referred to as the Domestic Peace Corps. Now the program, as far as I know, is only a local program. Like, you can work in your own community. But I did that program, and they sent me to Alaska, and I was from the East Coast. I was an East Coast, just graduated from college person, and I wanted to join. I didn't want to do the Peace Corps because I was very idealistic, and I was afraid of messing up somebody's culture. But I thought, the United States, that's great. VISTA, that's what I did. And I cannot tell you how meaningful experience this program was for me. It was terrific. And P.S., I was a waitress for a little while, many years later, as a moonlighting job, and I agree with you that it really does teach you a lot, and it's very, very good also. But I just wanted to put that out there. It's too bad that the government doesn't continue with that as a national recruit program where they can send you to anywhere in the United States for a year to work. We worked at the time with existing programs. We didn't just go out there and land on the ground and have to figure out what to do. They trained us. Whatever. It was amazing. A really amazing experience. And I would recommend it highly. Yeah.
I would actually donate to some kind of program that sends some of these little entitled socialists to an actual socialist country and make them live there for 3 months. And
sounds good to me. Yeah.
See how that works out. You know, or some of them to an actual real third world country who complain about America, because I think too many people don't realize how good they have it. And
for
I
sure,
know
for sure.
I sound like I'm 800 years old right now, don't I? I sound like I'm going to keep the ball if it comes in my yard, right?
You sound idealistic to me. Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you, Andrea. By the way, that is my confirmation name is Andrea. Thank you for joining me here on the Brian Kilmeade Show, Andrea. Yeah, I there's so many things. I think the further you get away from your immigration story, I think the bigger jerk you become. I really do. Not everybody, but a lot of people have no clue how good they have it. In Florida, Steve, welcome. You're on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Happy New Year, Steve.
Hey, Happy New Year. Hey, absolutely not at the federal level. You know, between the industrial complex, the military-industrial complex, and the fat federal government, there's no way you want to make that a federal program. Maybe at the state level, but definitely not. Because, you know, they never found a war that they didn't like. We're dropping bombs all over the place. It's crazy, you know? This is what we voted for? No way.
All right. So what about the idea of doing it here domestically, doing it here in the United States? We don't ship you anywhere. You stay here. Or the other idea that someone else brought up, you have to do a year of serving people somehow, doing retail service, or maybe working in like a nursing home for a year with older people to maybe gain some kind of respect for quote unquote boomers. Something along those lines to help other Americans.
Only at the state level. You cannot give the federal government that kind of power anymore. They can't. They cannot control themselves when it comes to any power. The states have to take back more power. What you're talking about is not in the Constitution. We got to get back to the Constitution.
Of course, the draft wasn't in the Constitution either, but yet we did that.
Well, and that for Vietnam, that was out of line. You know, I'll tell you something. We need to bring back. Hell no, we won't go. All right.
Another so was it out of line for world? Was it out of line for World War? Was it out of line for World War One and World War Two and etc.?
You know something? It's like when you look at all the stinking wars and all the rearrangement and how things led up to the wars. It's crazy. It really is crazy.
Okay. All right. Steve, I appreciate your passion. You're very, very passionate about it. I understand that. I get it. I don't think anyone is talking about, you know, drafting people to send them off to war. I don't think this is a draft of any kind. This is just a, you know, kick young people's butts a little bit into you know, serving America for 1 year. For everything that you get from this country, I don't think serving for 1 year in some capacity, and I mean everybody, I don't care if you weigh 400 pounds and you're disabled or whatever, well, you know what? We're going to work on that too for the 1 year. And you do something. I'm not saying everybody's got to run around with a gun on their shoulder, but doing something in some service where you have to interact with people and you have to show up on time and you have to show respect and you have to learn how to function like a human and maybe develop some empathy for other people. I think all of that's good. Let's go back to WABC. Shawnee, out of New York City, you're on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Welcome.
Oh, Sean, yes, thank you. I listened to you yesterday, and I just love everything you say. It's ditto, ditto, and amen.
thank you.
I grew up way long time ago. I may be 800 years old. I really did walk to school in the snow. But
so did I.
Oh, my God. And I didn't have TV till I was 8. And I'm so damn grateful for my childhood, which was innocent and responsible. And as I got older, I had to take a job to make money to buy Christmas presents. So I went to work for a department store in Houston, and I learned so much there. I learned things about myself because I learned that in helping others, I was really honing my responsibilities and my sensitivity to others. Is what did they need? For example, selling somebody a polyester blouse to save the money instead of the silk blouse. And he came back to thank me and gave me a charm for my charm bracelet. So, I mean, it was a really wonderful experience that I'm grateful for. So serving is not, it shouldn't be painful. It should be something people look back with pride and joy about.
Yeah. If you're the person who gets stuck having to refold all the clothes at Costco that are on the tables, you know, because I was there probably after Thanksgiving, before Christmas, and the men's department, the men were just picking stuff up and throwing it down and picking stuff up and throwing it down. And women do that too. But everything in my brain was just like, didn't your mother teach you how to put things back the way you found it? Like, So if you're the person who has to do that, you know, if that's your job working in some kind of customer service and that's what you have to do, you're going to learn appreciation for things like that and for how you leave things and how it affects other people. I think we've gotten super far away from that. I really do. Shawnee, have a wonderful, blessed new year. And thank you so much for joining me here. We've got one more round of calls. We've got more coming up here. All right. Before we run out of time, 866-408-7669 or tag me on X at Mary Walter Radio. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So Bob reached out to me on X and says, retail, seriously, no. Good show, though. I get it. That wouldn't be for everybody. Like, if you could tell me I had to, you know, work in retail, I'd be like, I'm not super good with people. John says, good morning, listening to you on WABC 77 NYC Radio. I agree with service for all. A plan should be passed through Congress, whether military, domestic service, community service. It would be very beneficial for all the reasons you stated and essential for kids. Yeah, I think it would be really good. And for some adults, too, let me tell you. Let's head to Virginia. Jason, welcome. You're on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hello.
Good morning, Mary. I've been enjoying your show. I'm calling from the perspective of a very long-time educator in public schools. And I think some of the implications that which you would have to be addressed to implement your program is the qualifications of the people who are supervising children. If you're trying to essentially cultivate integrity, using people that aren't their parents and have the kids have no accountability to anybody so far, how are the people going to be qualified to take on these service workers?
Well, probably just as qualified as the shift a supervisor at the Gap, right? Or at Starbucks or anything else. Like if they go in there and get a job at 16, which you can get a job at 16 depending on your state. All my nieces worked at 16. Their supervisor was a kid who was probably like 18, 19 years old.
How are you going to induce a supervisor to take on the service workers?
Well, they would be an employee just like anybody else. They'll get paid just like they were an employee.
Oh, I see. It sounded earlier to me, or I interpreted it like it was volunteerism. The nice lady earlier was talking about how she served in Vista.
Right, that was a different program.
And she had supervisors who taught her.
Right.
So maybe I misunderstood that part.
That was a totally different program. You know, this started out with Dwight Howard, really talking more about military, like 1 year of military. You go in, you get your butt kicked in boot camp, which is what a lot of kids need. A lot of kids need that because they don't have any respect or they did not have a strong father figure in their lives, that's your dad's job. That's what your dad does. And as more and more kids don't have a father figure in their lives, I see the value of military for our young men and women, where they learn respect, where they learn this is what you're going to do. And there is a power higher than you in the world. And no one cares about how many people follow you on Instagram or anything along those lines. These are the values that count. And you instill respect. You instill a respect for authority. You instill getting along and having to work with other people, even if you don't like them. So I do see the value in that as well. So it's two different things because someone else had said, well, what about customer service, like retail or something like that?
You're going to have an impact on the culture of every organization these service workers join. Maybe positive, maybe not.
It may be positive, it may be not. Personally, I think he may be right when it comes to some kind of military service for a year, just to maybe break you of some bad habits and get you some good ones. Like, I don't know, getting out of bed in time to go through life. Maybe that's a good one. But I don't see the, you know, people scream about, you're bringing back the draft. And people will scream about that. So maybe it could be a hybrid. And everyone's just spitballing here. We're just having fun with it. Jason, have a wonderful new year. And thank you for joining me here on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Let's go to Clifton, New Jersey, the People's Socialist Republic of New Jersey. Tony, listening on WABC out of New York. Welcome. You're on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi.
Hi, Mary. Happy almost New Year.
All you too.
2026. So I'm just a God and country kind of girl, and I did military 2 years out of high school. I volunteered after a breakup, believe it or not. So I would suggest, I would definitely suggest, I'm a God and country. I think any school, any public schools that want funding need to give young people the option of, you know, if you want any government funding, you need to offer your grads and prepare them for either some kind of military service, optional, with benefits. I received an education. I received college benefits, so that was great. Or you could work in any kind of non-government, you know, or maybe another option. But any schools that want to get government funding need to make a path for our young people. They need it.
And this would not just be colleges of which you're speaking, like even high schools, because I think there are a lot of young men in this country that are very lost and, yeah, and don't have that male figure in their lives, and they need it. And a lot of the young ladies as well, because daddy kicks both butts, whether it's his son or his daughter, daddy kicks both butts in different ways. I think a lot of them need that. So I would like to see it available even on a high school level.
Even on a high school level, and it gives people direction, and it gives them sort of a discovery time. You know, you don't need to stay in the military. You don't need to stay in whatever sort of maybe even these programs where you could go to sort of a Christian school, or you could go to a sort of a, not a military school, but a sort of like a where you learn a trade school.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the kind of things that keep young people focused and keep our young people ready, because they were traumatized quite a bit, Mary, during COVID.
I agree. We really broke an entire generation. Tony, I wish you a blessed 2026. Thank you so much for joining me. And lastly, let's get Alexander in North Carolina in here. I got about a minute and a half. Alexander, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks. What do you think about this?
I'm going to respectfully have to disagree. I'm active duty military, and you know, when it comes down to forced service, only about, you know, I think it's 23% of military-aged people are even eligible if it's, you know, medical reasons or what have you. And being active duty, I see so much incompetence day-to-day with people, and these are people who, you know, willingly joined.
So let me ask you, and thank you. I'm so glad that you joined. Thank you. We need more young men and women like you. So I admire that. So thank you for that. But what I think what we're talking about here is, you know, and I say this all the time, everybody has value, every human has value, and everybody can do something. And I think there's a lot of dignity in accomplishing something. So yeah, you're 400 pounds, you don't qualify for the military. Okay. But you're still going to go through a lot of what they go through, and you're going to do some of the exercises, and we're going to get some weight off of you, but you're going to learn to get out of bed at a certain time. You're going to learn to make your bed. You're going to learn that there's a power higher than you. And same thing with people who have physical handicaps. I still think that they have value, and I still think there are things they can do. And maybe it doesn't have to be military service. Maybe it could be a program that companies bring these kids in to, you know, to work at you know, American Eagle. Folding clothes and waiting on people and learn, or going into senior centers or doing something where you find that you have value. I think that that can be really useful. I don't know. Alexander, we got to run. Thank you again so much for your service. Have a blessed 2026. And thank you for joining me. I'm Mary Walter. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I am Mary Walter, sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. If you would like to join me, 866-408-7669 is my number. Or you can reach out to me on X at Mary Walter Radio. My podcast, my live cast tonight on Rumble, YouTube, and Getter. Just look for Mary Walter Radio on all three of those. And it starts around 7:15 p.m. Eastern Time. Let's go now to a guest, Lila Rose. Lila is the president and founder of Live Action. You can find her on X at Lila Grace Rose. And if you want to check them out, it's liveactionjust.org. They have videos, they have articles, they have pretty much everything you could want to check out about abortion and life and, donating your organs. I mean, it's incredible. There's just so much stuff there. You can go definitely down the rabbit hole. I highly recommend it. Lila Rose, welcome to the Brian Kilmeade Show and Happy New Year to you.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me on, Mary. Good morning.
Good morning. So, you know, with the midterms coming up, a lot of people feel that Republicans are just going to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, as they often do. And you feel that affordability is the big issue. Affordability. And for whatever reason, people think that the economy isn't that great, despite gas going low, despite the price of eggs being down. It's like they forgot that eggs were $5 a dozen, right? And now they're like $1.82 or whatever it is where you live. And that gas in some states was $7 a gallon. In some states now it's below $2 in some states. So affordability being the issue, how do Republicans beat the what's coming from the left and what's coming from the media about this economy is terrible, this economy is terrible? They're believing it. How do they stop that?
Well, listen, in the last 10 years, it has become increasingly harder. You know, it goes beyond even the Biden administration, right? It's become increasingly harder as a young person to imagine a future, to be able to buy a home, to be able to get out of student loan debt, to be able to find a job that can not just cover the bills, but make a path for the future for having a family. And I think there's a big reason, Mary, that America's fertility rate has fallen to historic lows, only 1.62 kids per couple. You know, you need 2.1 kids per couple to replace yourself as a population. We're at 1.62. And I think it's very difficult for younger generations to imagine a future, especially because of the cost of things like housing. And so, you know, eggs might be cheaper than they were before. Gas might be cheaper than it was before. These are all very good things. When we think about how do we make America a place that's more hospitable for families and a future for young people, I think we need to look at things like addressing the cost of raising kids and housing from a public policy perspective. So that's one thing that I think if Republicans want to be, win and do well, they should really focus on how do we make America a more friendly place to raise a family. Now, there's a spiritual sickness that I think our country deals with as well, where we're not valuing human life enough, we're not valuing children enough. But when you couple that with economic woes, it becomes, I think, it almost feels insurmountable for many young people, especially couples, to imagine that future. So I think Republicans really need to zero in on addressing housing costs and making it, making America seem like a more healthy and thriving place for them to be able to have that family future that they may want.
And part of this is, too, it's not just it's not just the costs. You have New York, the city council just passed something called the Community Opportunity to Purchase Act, and it allows certain nonprofits to have the first chance to buy a multifamily property before they're allowed to be sold on the open market. So if you have a multifamily property that you want to sell, you have to wait 6 months before and allow a community group, a nonprofit, buy the property before you're allowed to even put it on the market. So the government is getting more and more and more involved in real estate transactions and who gets to buy certain things. Whereas, you know, you and your partner say, we're going to buy this, we're going to rent out the other units, it'll pay for itself, this is going to be a great investment. Not so fast. The New York City now is saying you can't do that. Just there's a lot working against them.
Yes. I mean, I think that's a great example. There's a lot of red tape when it comes to building homes, when it comes to buying homes. Yeah. You know, obviously there's sky high interest rates, and the fact that we have, you know, broken zoning rules. I mean, I'm out in California and the zoning is terrible. It's so hard to build. You can't even put an ADU on your property in a lot of parts of California. So all of that is a reason why it's more difficult for young people and really anybody, quite frankly, to have home ownership. And I do think that's such an important, cornerstone of coming of age and being able to build a family. Again, not that you can't build a family without having a home. You can, you know, rent, but then you're in this cycle of constant renting. You're not building potential for generational wealth. So that does have a real impact on our fertility rate. It has a real impact on what people think about when they go into the voting booth and who they're voting for, because they really want to be able to have housing, to be able to, you know, many people still want to have a family. There's sadly, Mary, this increasing number now of young people who can't even imagine having a family, and they don't even want to have kids anymore. Yeah. But for those that still do, they are eager for some public policy that supports that family vision. And I think the public policy has to be restrained, because it can't just be giving out, you know, huge amounts of cash, because that's going to have its own economic problems down the line. But I think things like child tax credits, in addition to helping solve the housing crisis, are another wonderful solution, where you actually give people a much bigger write-off on their taxes because they're having children and they're willing to, again, raise the next generation. I do think cash credits for families are one of the few areas where it makes sense to give out a cash subsidy, because, again, the most important thing any government should be thinking about is families. And are we going to have a healthy next generation that can continue the American, you know, the American dream and the American project?
Yeah, and we talked a lot about this housing thing yesterday on the show, and talked about how, you know, bringing back the idea of teaching our kids about roommates when they first get out of college, you know, like continuing the roommate thing. Don't get a two-bedroom apartment on your own. Get a studio. There are other things we can do. But let's talk about, also, you talk about momflation. What is momflation?
So the reality is, it is getting more and more costly to buy anything, whether it's goods or services, whether that's childcare, whether that is, you know, the milk at the grocery store. And it's not even so much the cost of one product or service, but it's the overall price level of all of the goods and services in the economy. And you look at the price of groceries, right? 5 to 10 years ago, and it has skyrocketed. And so you can go and try to tweak the cost of eggs or tweak the cost of gas, and that's, of course, helpful. But overall, that grocery bill has grown significantly. Overall, any household goods, you know, the thing that cost, $30 at Target 5 years ago is now $34.99. Those prices across the board, and economists are seeing this, have risen. And so what hasn't risen as quickly, Mary, are wages. What hasn't risen as quickly is people's ability to pay all of those new costs. And so people are realizing their dollar doesn't go as far as it used to. And again, that's addressing, the fertility rate. It's addressing people's even desire to get married. They're less likely now. Less people are the marriage rate is down overall. You know, there's sometimes a little blip that goes up, but overall, young people, Gen Zers, are less interested in marriage than their predecessors. So all of this, I think, is connected to the economy, and in terms of what the government response can be. I just think focusing on, yes, more affordable housing, removing restrictions so people can build, so people can buy, so people can put up ADUs, so people can have more folks in their homes and be able to rent, like you said, to other people, or do multi-family units. All of that is good, but I think also giving families special increased tax credits as well as cash subsidies to deal with the rising cost is another solution.
Yeah. I'm just going to get you to hang on here. We're going to take a quick break, because I do want to comment a little bit about what you were saying with Gen Z, and also want to talk to you about something that Governor Hochul has agreed to sign in New York that I think is very scary. So we've got more coming up. Don't go anywhere. Lila Rose on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
And welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Mary Walter with my guest, Lila Rose, the president and founder of Live Action. You can find her on X at Lila Grace Rose, and it's liveaction.com. Online if you want to check them out. So we were talking about, you know, the plight of Gen Z and how hard it is for them and how hard it is for them to find a home, etc. And I think part of what I'm going to say here, part of the reason I think that things are different is they have fallen away from religion, the vast majority of them. They live together before marriage. A lot of them never get married. And then some of them do get married because they're pressured into getting married because they've been living together for so long. And a lot of them will have the baby before marriage. And to me, and then they seem like they should just be able to have the big house right away. You know, I think they have a skewed vision, and we talked about this yesterday, a skewed vision of what life was like for boomers and for Gen X before them. And, you know, I'm Gen X. I bought my first house at almost 40. Right? But yet they seem to be able to think that they, you know, well, we've been living together for 3 years, so now we should be able to have our house and we get to upgrade all of our stuff at a shower, and I should have this and I should have that, and we should have, you know, Amazon Prime and all of these subscriptions, and be able to order all my meals out because I don't have time to cook. So I think there's a societal skewing of what reality was before them and what it was for generations before them, as well as some certain things that are working against them. But every generation has stuff that works against them. And I think that comes into play. And I also feel that, you know, if they're into going to here for the weekend and going to there for the weekend, you can't do that with a kid. It's not an Instagram life if you have a child.
That's a very, those are some very good points. And there's a lot of truth to that. You know, we have, every generation has its challenges. Gen Z and millennials will have ours. I'm a millennial. It's going to be different than Gen X and boomers. That's all very true. I do think there's a few other pieces to the puzzle there for why Gen Z is not marrying as much, why Gen Z is cohabitating more before marriage, why Gen Z is basically afraid of commitment, as well as many millennials. And I think the reason for that has to do in part with to the divorce rate of their predecessors. You look at the divorce rate of boomers as an example, and they have the highest divorce rate of any generation. So when you're raised in divorcing and divorced homes, it's very difficult to imagine that future and see it as a good one, the future of getting married. And so I think a lot of Gen Zers and many millennials are instead thinking, well, maybe I'm just going to cohabitate or just not marry at all or even commit in cohabitation because it seems safer than going through the chaos of a divorce. So I do think that's a real element at work here. I think you're right, though, about the impact of social media and just really living a more consumeristic, materialistic lifestyle that's based on fun experiences and having stuff. I do think that keeping up with the Joneses effectively in a new kind of world of consumerism where everything's available when you click a button and a DoorDash shows up, or, you know, your Uber shows up or your Amazon delivery shows up. It makes this idea of what my future should look like different. And so you have these different standards that maybe previous generations had. And I do think another element that's real is, you know, Abigail Schreier wrote a great book about bad therapy. This idea that you can go to therapy and you can do worse afterwards. You know, you go to therapy and you talk about your childhood wounds, maybe from that divorce your parents had. And instead of getting healthier and more resilient and stronger afterwards, you're kind of in this downward spiral of negative thinking about yourself, mm-hmm. your future, and your past, quite frankly. And it can wound your relationships instead of heal them. And I do think there's some truth to that, too. I mean, I do think some therapy can be amazing if you've got the right therapist. But if you are, basically the whole world is out to get me, right? I'm the perpetual victim. I can't heal. And my parents just hurt me and just loaded me up with a load of baggage. That negative mindset going into your life is going to cripple your future, right? Whether or not it's true, it's just going to cripple your true future. And so I think we need to get more resilient, and that includes spiritual revival, knowing we're loved by God, we have a future, and it has a lot to do with forgiving previous generations for their issues. Every generation will have ours. And then the public policy we were discussing earlier, you know, the government making it easier to have a family and housing, I think is another key part of the solution.
Yeah, ultimately, I do agree with you. As the key to 2026 is stressing affordability and trying to counter the narrative that comes from the media that everything's too expensive, you can't afford anything, when in reality, a lot of people are like, wait, I don't see that. But I think that's a big hurdle for the Republicans, and I hope they do it. I just want to get in here very quickly. New York, the Democrat New York governor, Kathy Hochul, announced that she's going to assign an assisted suicide bill for terminally ill individuals. She insisted that there be amendments included to this bill, including a mandatory waiting period of 5 days between when a prescription is written and when it is filled, an oral request by a patient for assisted suicide that must be recorded by video or audio, mandatory mental health evaluation of the person seeking assisted suicide by a psychologist or psychiatrist, a prohibition against anyone who may benefit financially from being eligible to serve as a witness, limiting assisted suicide in New York to New York residents only, and allowing religiously oriented home hospice providers to opt out of offering assisted suicide. I'm sure you have a lot to say about that, so I'm just going to let you have at it.
Thanks, Mary. I do. I mean, this is absolutely a devastating decision by Governor Kathy Hochul. The fact that she says she will sign New York's, they call it Medical Aid in Dying Act. Really, it is assisting suicide for vulnerable, very vulnerable adults. And what is happening here is you're turning doctors, and we saw this with abortion, you're turning doctors into agents of death. And you're telling people who are sick or have crippling disabilities or they're depressed, right? You're telling them that their lives are a burden. And so it creates this quiet pressure on the elderly, on those who are very sick, to choose death so that they're not a cost or an inconvenience to their families or to medical providers. And so once the state is authorizing suicide, which is what Kathy Hochul is doing, she's authorizing suicide, physician-assisted suicide. Despair is no longer something that we have to fight or treat, right? Help this person get out of despair, help them get healthier, you know, pray for the miracle. Instead, despair is something that needs to be facilitated by the system. And this is a policy of death, and it's a policy of abandonment. And the horrible part about this is they're dressing it up as compassion. You know, they're saying this is going to be compassionate. It's going to help people. No, this is killing people. It's never right to take an innocent life. And people who are suffering need care. You don't eliminate the sufferer. You work as best you can to alleviate and when possible, eliminate the suffering, but never the sufferer.
Yeah, and she said she did it because she watched her mom die with ALS. And my husband is on a board that aids ALS patients. And I have to tell you, I know a lot of them. And I get it. I have to tell you, I get it. I get where they get to the point because their brains are still functioning, but their bodies are not. And it's horrific to watch sometimes. So I kind of understand that. So I have such mixed emotions about the whole thing where it may not be for me, but who am I to tell someone who's suffering with like ALS that I'm sorry, you got to keep going until you just die? I don't know. It's really hard, but I think it will be misused, and that's what scares me. And that's the problem I have with that. We have to end it on that. I'm so sorry. Lila Rose, thank you so much for joining me. I wish you a 2026 with lots of blessings and love and laughter, and thank you for all the work you do. And thank you for joining me on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Mary Walter sitting in for Brian Kilmeade. Just a couple days left until the new year. It's very exciting. Joining us now, Dr. Mehmet Oz. He is the Medicare and Medicaid Services Administrator. You can follow him on X at Dr. Oz. That's super easy, Dr. Oz. Thank you so much for taking the time to join me on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Welcome and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Mary, and I'd say dramatic step up to have you hosting instead of Brian, and thank you for taking charge, taking the reins of the show.
Wow, thank you. And not only that, but I am cuter than he is. So. Well,
everything's better. I hope he's listening.
That's it. I'm never going to work on this show again. I hope you're happy. So the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services announced that all 50 states are going to receive awards. Under this Rural Health Transformation Program, it's $50 billion initiative. And the first thing that comes to mind, like, yay, I think this is great because rural health has really been hit hard, especially when you have like a lot of illegals who hit some of these hospitals along the southern border and a lot of them closing. And even in, as far inland as Colorado, we need to help these rural areas, these rural hospitals. But then I hear that, like, well, wait a minute, on the heels of all this Somali fraud, we're talking about $50 billion. How are there certain safeguards that are in place to make sure that this money just doesn't disappear?
There are safeguards, Mary, and there's a very big difference between Medicare, which takes care of older Americans, and Medicaid, which takes care of folks who are most vulnerable. Right? They both need support. They both need our love. But within the Medicaid program, there's inherently an issue because we don't actually get to make all the decisions. A lot of decisions are made by the states. They just sort of give us the bill. And even though the federal taxpayer is on the hook, it's not like we have a tremendous amount of insight into how they spend the money. The Rural Health Transformation Fund is a completely different ballgame. It's true that it's coming out of my agency, CMS, but the president and Congress wanted to make sure that we gave it to the governors and then had very tight controls over how the money was spent so that it would represent the largest investment ever in rural health care at a time when rural health care is really suffering. It also would allow us to, by increasing by 50% the money that these rural areas are getting, it would allow them to transform, to right-size their systems. And that's the aspiration that we all have. And that's what I'm confident we'll deliver. We just doled the money out yesterday on time, on schedule. All the judging was done, all the applications to tell us exactly how you're going to spend the money without wasting it. All that now is in the books. This information, most of it's public. I encourage the public to look at it. But there are no Somalians distributing rural health transformation funds. It is directly given to governors. They are directly liable. And we're not going to have the kind of shenanigans that took place in Minnesota when the governor wasn't watching, because we're watching.
Yeah, and tell people about this a little bit, about the condition of some of our more rural hospitals, because most of America, believe it or not, is rural once you get off the two coasts. But there's more than 700 rural hospitals that are at risk of closure, and that's a lot. And I realize that they're smaller and they may not have as a big of a service area, but they're still incredibly important. What happened? How did we get here?
Well, we got to this problem years of abuse and ignoring the problem. If you're a big hospital system located in an urban area, you're pretty good at lobbying to get money spent the way that you think it should be spent in your town. Even if Medicaid's giving the state money, most of it does tend to go to the bigger institutions that have lobbyists and are well-connected. The rural parts of the state are at the very bottom of the food chain. They just never quite get heard. And so this transformation fund's desire is to start to take advantage of tips that have worked in other parts of the country in the healthcare system. As an example, if you're using technology to improve the quality of your healthcare, if you're using medical records that are electronic, if you have quality control on tools like telemedicine, that all now becomes accessible to rural parts of the country where your zip code determines your life expectancy. Shockingly, you tend to live a lot shorter in rural America because of these problems with things like delivering healthy babies with appropriate supervision, access to cancer care, and the like. By forcing rural America to re-envision what healthcare looks like there, we can take advantage of 21st century solutions. All the states have this problem. All of them want these issues addressed. None of them had the freedom given by both financial security, but also the way this program is designed to actually make these tough decisions. Now they have. And when I say freedom, we have the ability to claw money back if it's not used the way people have promised to use it, which is actually empowering to governors. Now they can go to the state health commissioner and say, guys, you're not spending the money in the right way because you're not giving pharmacists the ability to function at the height of their licensure. Or you go to the doctors groups and say, hey, we have a better way to provide health care that requires telemedicine, but you've got to lighten up a little bit on some of the rules that you guys have, the vice grip you have on how medicine is practiced. We can give high-quality access care to all people in our state. Those decisions historically have been they pushed to the side. Now state legislatures are on the hook. If they don't do SNAP waivers, if they don't allow for the president's fitness test to be given in schools, they will pay the price. That gives the governor a tool to force change.
Yeah, I'm glad we're bringing, on a side note, the president's physical fitness test back, because I still have trauma from trying to climb that damn rope and touch the beam at the top of the gym with a 1-inch thick mat underneath me should I fall.
Very honest to goodness, that has come up in every conversation I've had with members of the administration. All of us survived that. I didn't live in like heights, but I think we'll have a safer version of it. But you just described very accurately the death-defying 5-year-old moves we all had to make.
Yeah, and they had like a, they put a mat under you that was like a quarter of an inch thick in case you to break your fall as you're plummeting to the gym floor.
It's a body bag. That's all it was good for. They'd wrapped up the pieces to keep the floor clean.
Exactly. It's somehow our parents were like, well, next time you won't fall. It's, when this money goes to these states, you say, you talk about the state legislature. Are we truly going, though, to give the money to the hospitals? How is the money going to be allocated? I really want the physicians and the nurses and you know, the techs to be the ones who decide what they need, because they're the ones who deal with it every single day. And having lawyers make that decision, to me, is just not a good formula.
I'm a firm believer in subsidiarity, which is a Catholic term that basically advocates what you're saying. Let the lowest ranking person who's capable of the decision make the choice. You don't want the Pope deciding on some parish issue if the parish priest is just good at, just fine at making that choice. So we want hospitals and healthcare systems right-sized by the people who work in them. And that starts, by the way, with bringing in more doctors and nurses and pharmacists. We don't have enough in rural parts of the country. So there's no point me providing more funding for mental health care services if there are literally no psychologists and psychiatrists working anywhere near you. But we could have telemedicine solutions or begin to use AI if these doctors and nurses want it. And by giving them control, and this is the beauty of this plan, we're forcing innovation. By putting this kind of support, structured financial support into rural healthcare, when they make smart decisions, they're going to pass those best practices onto the urban areas as well. So the entire healthcare system is going to get better. And why? Because the president cares about this stuff. Congress was wise in how it crafted the policy. Notice, the law was signed by the president July 4th. We have already dished out all of the money for the first year. On time, on schedule, high quality. Everyone's up, you know, people can complain about how much money they got, but they can't complain about the process. It was fair.
Yeah, and having you in charge of it, I like having more doctors involved. I think we could solve, honestly, I think we could solve the healthcare problem in this country by putting Congress, taking away their Cadillac health plan, put them on the Obamacare exchanges, and within a week, you're going to solve the healthcare problem in this country. We put lawyers in charge of it instead of doctors, and to me, that was the biggest mistake we made concerning healthcare in this country. It's ridiculous.
Right,
Dr. Oz, thank you so much for joining me. It was a pleasure, and best of luck. I love that there's a doctor involved in this and running the show and saying this is what needs to be done. It's a very welcome change, and all the best in the new year. Lots of blessings to you.
God bless you. Take care, Mary.
Thank you. More coming up. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
The headlines, the stories behind them, and the people who make them. Only on The Brian Kilmeade Show. A talk show that's real. This is The Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
I think it's sad. I think that those Border Patrol agents are going to have a difficult time when they're out in the field and they see what actually happens in real life, separate from their training. But I do understand that their primary incentive is financial.
Okay, so that there. That was Mayor Karen Bass, mayor of Los Angeles. She's on CNN on Friday. And she was talking about Latino border agents. Or Hispanic border agents. Whatever, but you get the point. And I heard that, and I thought, huh. Well, that's kind of weird. What she's saying is that the only reason that Hispanics sign up to join the Border Patrol is financial. It's financial. And when they see what's happening to their fellow Hispanics, Latinos, etc., fill in the blank, that they're going to regret it. They're going to come to hate their life, and they're going to come to regret what they're doing. The people who are on the Border Patrol did it the right way. They came into the country legally. If you ever speak to someone who is a recent immigrant, they don't like illegal immigrants, because the ones who did it the right way jumped through the hoops, did what they had to do. They respected our laws. They waved the American flag, not the Mexican flag or whichever flag from wherever you're from. They don't wave the flag of the country that they fled when they came here. They wave the American flag. I don't know if my Uber driver yesterday which flag he was waving, because I couldn't understand a word the man said. But this idea on the left, when you think about it, is really racist. Like, they really let the mask drop every now and then. And what Karen Bass basically said is, A, the people who are breaking our laws are Hispanic. There's never any Chinese or Somalians or people from the Ivory Coast or Germany or Latvia or anywhere else that are crossing our border illegally. No, it's Hispanics. Well, that's a pretty racist assumption. And if I made that assumption, you would call me a racist just solely based on the color of my skin, which is, again, racist. So they're racists at heart when you come down to it. And to assume that there are no Hispanics in this country who believe in the rule of law is, again, racist. So what we learned from this is Karen Bass, when you scratch the surface, there's a racist underneath all of that. Think about the ridiculousness of that. I just want to get to some stories here quickly. Victor Davis Hanson, I know you know him. He said he is stepping away from his show. Victor Davis Hanson, in his own words, he has a podcast, and he said, "I'm having a major operation, and I've been presented with a serious problem, but I'm going to do all I can to solve it, and that's all I can do, and trust in the power of prayer and faith and in a wonderful surgeon. I finally ended up going to the best medical center I know, Stanford Med, and the people there have been absolutely wonderful. I'll work it out one way or another." He joined the Daily Signal in January. He's a senior fellow with the Hoover Institution. He said on his Friday show that he has not wanted to discuss his health issues and that the nine-month odyssey he has been on. So he didn't want to talk about either one of those things. So it came as a bit of a surprise on Friday to people who listened to Victor Davis Hanson. "The problem I had for a non-smoker and non-drinker was a very rare type and very hard to diagnose, so it's no one's fault other than my own, perhaps, for not realizing why I was not getting well." He added that he'll, quote, "be fine," and he thanked his extraordinarily kind fans for their recent concern. His co-host Jack Fowler will anchor the program, solo while Victor Davis Hanson recovers. So prayers up for Victor Davis Hanson today if you are of the praying type. It sounds like he could use them. All right, so the Kennedy Center, you know, there was that guy who canceled his Christmas Eve. They do a jazz concert. They've done it for the last 20 years. And his name is Chuck Redd. I never heard of him, but he's a vibraphonist. Okay. I don't know if there's a market for vibraphonists, but apparently he was going to play Kennedy Center. And he canceled hours before the event was scheduled to take place. And he said it's because he saw the name of Trump, the Donald Trump and John F. Kennedy Center for Music, right? And so Rick Grinnell sends him a letter saying, "Your dismal ticket sales and lack of donor support combined with your last-minute cancellation has cost us considerably. This is your official notice that we will seek $1 million in damages from you for this political stunt." I'm like, yes! Yes! When you're a vibraphonist, I guess maybe like the world is small. I don't understand, but I don't know if he's got $1 million to pay them back. He said, "Your decision to withdraw at the last moment as explicitly in response to the center's recent renaming, which honors President Trump's extraordinary efforts to save this national treasure, is classic intolerance and very costly to a nonprofit arts institution. Regrettably, your action surrenders to the sad bullying tactics employed by certain elements on the left who have sought to intimidate artists into boycotting performances at our National Cultural Center." Well, not to be undeterred, here comes the Cookers. They are also a jazz ensemble, and they canceled two New Year's Eve shows because they're going to show us. They gave no reason for the decision, only saying it has come together very quickly. They wrote on their website that jazz was born from struggle and from a relentless insistence on freedom, freedom of thought, of expression, and of the full human voice. Some of us have been making this music for many decades, and that history still shapes us. We are not turning away from our audience, and we want to make sure that when we do return to the bandstand, the room is able to celebrate the full presence of the music and everyone in it. Here's my thing. The irony and hypocrisy of the left. These people, the left, these people, are the ones who tore down statues and scratched names out of monuments because they didn't like the person. And they were all for that, and they cheered when they destroyed public property. They cheered. But now when someone puts a name on something and they don't like that name, oh, well, they're going to have nothing to do with that. How dare you do something like that? That's horrible. Now they're offended. But it's perfectly okay when they do it. The hypocrisy abounds. So far the Kennedy Center has not offered a public comment in response to the cancellation. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens here as some of these artists take their, you know, take their marbles and go home. So I wonder if there will now be another $1 million lawsuit in response to this. And think about the people, their fans for both of these, for the vibraphonist and this jazz trio. And I'm sure that they're wonderful at what they do, and I'm sure they make great music. But it's an honor to play at the Kennedy Center. And everybody still calls it the Kennedy Center. For Lord's sake, they still call it the Kennedy Center. I just think that, you know, maybe there's going to be a bit of a backlash here, especially from their fans who now can't go see them and had plans and maybe hotel reservations, etc. Yeah. All right. Well, that's what happens when you pitch a fit. I'm Mary Walter. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.